This is Jim Inkster, and welcome to Talk Louisiana. Signature support from the office of the Mayor President of East Baton Rouge Parish. The show originates from Investar Tower in Baton Rouge, and we're pleased and honored to have as our first guest at post Memorial Day the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, James Michael Johnson, the pride of Benton, Louisiana, graduate of the Paul M. Hebert Law Center at LSU, also an undergraduate degree from the Old War School. Captain Shreve, son of a firefighter who was injured and wounded badly on the job, a guy who has ascended to the top spot in the U.S. House of Representatives. He is head of all 435 members, and good morning to you, Speaker Johnson.
Hey, Jim. Great to hear your voice, my friend.
It's nice to talk with you. And 7 months into the job, is it everything you thought it would be?
And so much less. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's been a pretty wild ride. It's been surreal. This is not a job I ever aspired to. Jim, I was content to be a lieutenant in the leadership structure here, but this is how things developed, and we're very honored to have the position. I'm very clear-eyed and focused about where we need to go as a country and how we need to get back to the extraordinary place we were before the last 3.5 years under the Biden administration. And it's a big, tall task. I mean, Newt Gingrich posted an op-ed 2 weeks ago and said, Speaker Johnson has the most challenging speakership since the Civil War 160 years ago. And I called him. I said, is this some kind of interesting way of trying to encourage me, Newt? And we laughed about it. He said, no, did you read the rest of the piece? I said, you're doing an excellent job. It's just the job in the modern Congress is nearly impossible. I said, it's not impossible. We're going to get this job done. We're going through a valley right now, Jim, but it's much brighter on the other side. I can't wait to get to November.
You mentioned Newt Gingrich. He is a graduate a few times from Tulane, so he has a Louisiana connection as well. But you got the job in an unusual way, and you've already survived a few attempts to vacate the speakership. And coming from a part of your party that I don't have any doubt you're a conservative, but apparently not conservative enough for Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz. What's going on with that?
Well, Matt's actually a friend and a supporter. We classmates. Marjorie is kind of on an island by herself. And, the problem with Marjorie and a few others is they don't recognize the reality of our situation. The reason Newt Gingrich said that we have the most challenging speakership at the moment is because we have the smallest majority in U.S. history. I literally have a one vote margin. And so that means if we want to move a Republican priority, I can't lose a single vote. I mean, just one to spare. And so it's an extraordinary challenge. And then the other part is, of course, if we move a very conservative piece of legislation and one of our top priorities, it's dead on arrival in the Senate, because everybody has to remember the progressive Democrats control the White House and the Senate. Chuck Schumer is in charge in the other chamber. So we only control one half of one third of the federal government. And yet you have a few people who expect us to do massive transformational change in the midst of that. It's just simply not a possibility. So what we do every day is we try to advance the ball as far as we can up the field for our conservative principles and philosophy, because we genuinely believe, I do, that's what's best for the country, for individuals, families, states, and the nation. And, right now, as I use a football analogy, because I'm apt to do, I'm from Louisiana, this is not the moment for Hail Mary passes. This is 3 yards in a cloud of dust. You move the ball incrementally up the field. You get the next yard, the next first down, put some points on the board, and get to November. And I think we're going to have an extraordinary election cycle.
The election is in the offing, and as we speak, 22 weeks away. And congressional redistricting is such that Louisiana will now have two black majority districts. And the person affected most dramatically by this is the incumbent in the 6th District, Garrett Graves. Now, he says he's running for, quote, re-election. I take him at his word, but we don't know whether he's running for the 6th District or running against a fellow Republican. Your thoughts?
Well, I have lots of thoughts on this, as you might imagine. It remains my belief that the congressional maps that were passed after the 2020 census are fully constitutional, and they should be used in November. But, of course, we know the Supreme Court has stepped in now, suspended the Fifth Circuit decision on point, and now we've got to all fight to win in these newly drawn districts. I don't think anybody believes that these new districts are going to survive even one cycle. So we'll have them for 2 years. But Under the new map, you've got voters, for example, in Shreveport, the far north west corner of the state, my hometown, that are going to be voting for a congressman that will all but likely reside in Baton Rouge. And that just doesn't make sense to people. So, look, as House Speaker, my duty is to do everything in my power to maintain and grow the House Republican majority. And I just want to say on behalf of all my Republican colleagues, you know, there's six members in the House, of course, from Louisiana, five are Republican, one's Democrat. Of the five Republicans, we have the most powerful congressional delegation in the entire country. I mean, think of it. You've got just among the five of us, you know, you have me as Speaker of the House. You've got Steve Scalise as the majority leader. By the way, Jim, that's the first time in history that those two top positions have been elected right from the same state ever. You know, we have a key appropriator in Julia Letlow. We have a leader on transportation, infrastructure, natural resources, Garrett Graves. We've got a leader on armed services, homeland security. That's Clay Higgins. It's an incredible group. We need to keep all of them. And I'm really, really hopeful they'll work hard and win their districts again.
But it may not be that easy to do. Cleo Fields is a seasoned politician, and he will be running in a black majority district in the 6th district. From a strategical perspective, Garrett Graves would probably be better suited running against Julia Letlow, but that would mean a Republican against a Republican. And you as Speaker, that's not something I gather that you would relish.
No, not at all. And I have encouraged Garrett to think hard about running in that newly drawn district, even though it's different. And some of the prognosticators have suggested it's, you know, that it leans for the Democrats. I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. I think Garrett is a very strong candidate. I mean, he's delivered real tangible results for the state and for that region. I wouldn't bet against him. And I think that, you know, President Trump won Louisiana by record margins in 2016 and 2020. He'll be at the top of the ticket, of course, in November, and his support is growing. I think this is a coattails election situation across the country, certainly in Louisiana. I think turnout will be very strong because enthusiasm for the Republican side is strong, whereas it is not for Joe Biden and his team. I think it bodes very well. I think Garrett could win it, and I'm really hopeful he'll run in that district.
How do you see the national election?
I'm very bullish on November. I mean, look, I've traveled, you know, the speaker's job is to cover the whole map. So I've been so far, Jim, my team counted it up last weekend, over 110 cities and 29 states holding events for Republican members and candidates across the country. No matter where I am, the message is exactly the same. America's in decline. Everybody knows it. The current president is asleep at the wheel on every major issue, from the open border that he created to the terrible state of the economy, the rising cost of living, rising crime, I mean, the weakness on the world stage. I think that people have had enough. They're fed up. And I believe that this is going to be a very strong November. I'm convinced, Jim, that we're going to win the White House, win back the Senate for the Republican Party, and we're going to grow the House majority for the Republicans. And I think we'll be in much better shape as a nation after that is done.
Now, the former president, Donald Trump, is leading in the polls, no doubt, and we are 22 weeks away, but he's run two elections, and in both times he was defeated in the overall vote, although he did beat Hillary Clinton rather soundly in the Electoral College. Now, he is facing a potential conviction. Closing arguments begin today in New York City. You went to the trial a few weeks ago. You stood outside the courthouse and gave your plaudits to the former president. What's your take on the trial itself and how this will impact the election, if at all?
Well, the trial in Manhattan is just like the other that they're pursuing against him around the country. They have completely weaponized the system of justice. And the reason I gave those comments and I felt like it was important for me to go there is not as Speaker of the House so much as an individual citizen, an attorney, a former litigator myself, as an officer of the court. I'm just absolutely disgusted by what they've done to our system, because when the people begin to lose faith in the fairness of our justice system, you lose a critical component of what is necessary to keep a constitutional republic like we have, this grand experiment in self-governance. And so that's what's at stake here. And it's lawfare. I mean, it truly is. You have the prosecutors who are pursuing a political vendetta against the nominee for one of the major parties in the country for president. I mean, it's just unconscionable. So I think that all this will sift down. I think the American people see it for what it is. And this is really an important point to remember. 2024 will be the first time since 1892 that you have two actual presidents running against one another in the race. Not since Grover Cleveland defeated Benjamin Harrison have you had two persons who actually have four-year records to run upon? And so everybody knows you don't have to listen to talking points or rhetoric or pay attention to personalities. This is about policy. And the contrast couldn't be more clear. Everybody knows how they were doing under Trump and how they're doing under Biden. And that's why there's a massive demographic shift going on in the country right now with Hispanic voters and African-American voters and Jewish voters coming into the Republican Party for various reasons. They just want a fair shot, and they're not getting it under President Biden.
Do you think it'll be a close election?
It probably will, only because the nation is divided. But you've heard President Trump's latest campaign slogan he's been repeating the last few weeks on the trail. He says, make it too big to rig. And what he means is, you know, conservatives, Republicans need to come out early, vote early, bank your vote early. You know, don't take anything for granted.
We do have to take an 89.3-second break, and then we'll have Speaker Johnson with us for a few more moments. We're back after this quick timeout on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Speaker James Michael Johnson, who is the pride of Benton. That's his hometown, but he grew up in Shreveport, the son of a firefighter who gallantly did his job and paid as a result of his duty to his people. And Mike Johnson was affected dramatically by that and has been called to public service himself, and he is the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. And a few more items before we part company. Mike Johnson, when we left his visit just a few moments ago, was talking about defending Donald Trump in Manhattan, believing that this is prosecutorial misconduct, at least a witch hunt, if you will, echoing a lot of what the former president has said. But why do you think the president did not take the stand?
Well, if I were his lawyer, I would have advised him not to. You know, the only reason you would do that if you had a client in a situation like this is to help clear their name and correct the false evidence or testimony that was put against them, because there's always a risk that it'll, you know, be an inquest, and you don't want your client to be subjected to that, certainly when your client is running for president of the United States. But the problem that the prosecution has here is they put on the weakest case anyone's ever seen. I mean, they haven't even been able to accurately define a crime that he supposedly committed. And for that reason, I think the defense was correct to, you know, do their closing statements and rest the case. I think it will come out well. I don't think the jury could objectively look at what's been presented and convict him of anything.
Now, he has two issues here politically, and one is the hush money trial, and this involves payments, and if he's convicted, of course, he could face potential jail, although some believe, I think most, that that would never happen, but nonetheless, it would affect his political viability, presumably. But beyond that, as we know, this is also a trial about sex and supposedly a tryst with Stormy Daniels of Baton Rouge. And if you or I were accused of this and we didn't do it, there's no way they would keep me, and I don't think you, off the stand, Speaker Johnson.
Well, if you had good lawyers, they would. You wouldn't subject us to testimony if the prosecution had not presented accurate evidence of a crime. I mean, the whole purpose of this, remember, the reason we call it lawfare is that this is a political exercise. It's not a legal one. They're trying to intentionally detain President Trump, and they've done it successfully now for, 7 weeks? They've kept him mostly off the campaign trail and stuck in a crummy little courthouse in Manhattan. That was by design. They want the spectacle. They want to drag this out every single day in the media and say terrible things about his character and past behavior, whatever claims they can make. Remember, he has denied everything, all the allegations that have been stated. And, you know, that's the purpose. So playing into that and giving it more oxygen, I think it would be, since it is a political exercise, politically, that'd be a terrible idea. And I think the lawyers have given him good counsel here.
Do you think Stormy Daniels is telling the truth about her relationship, if you want to call it that, with the former president?
I don't know that any witness that's been put on the stand in this case has any credibility. Remember, their primary witness is Michael Cohen, who is obviously a proven liar on the stand. He's perjured himself in front of the courts and Congress and everybody else, the IRS.
he's you know, he admitted on the stand last week that he actually stole from the Trump organization, and they have videos of him saying he hates the man and wants him to go to jail. So now that's, if that's what they're building their case on, good luck with that. You know, I think that the president is trying to get this thing wrapped up so he can get back to the campaign and talk with the American people about the issues that they really, really care about. And that's the economy and crime and our standing on the world stage and the open border and all the rest. And he's right to do that.
A few moments ago when you said you want to make this, and you and the president, the former president, this election too big to rig. Now, former President Trump believes that he not only had his job taken away from him unfairly in 2020, but also that he got more votes than Hillary Clinton in 2016, and there has not been evidence to show either one is true. Why do we have a concern that the American system is flawed to the point where an election could be stolen? Is that really valid, or is that just politics from the former president?
Well, no, look, I tell you, that's, people around the country are deeply concerned about that. I mentioned all the cities I've been in doing campaign events, in more than 110 cities now around the country, from east to west, north to south. It doesn't matter where we are. Every public forum, that's either the first, second, or third question every single time is about election security, because people are concerned. They see what's happening. And the latest concern, Jim, is all these illegals. You know, since Joe Biden opened the border intentionally, by the way, 64 specific executive actions that we documented that he has taken since he walked into the Oval Office 3.5 years ago, they opened the border. They have, by some estimates, as many as 17 million illegals who have come into the country. Most of them are, we don't know where they are.
In the last three years?
The last three and a half years, yes. No one knows...
Well, taking you at your word, though, Mr. Speaker, I don't mean to interrupt, but I doubt, even if that number is correct, and it would seem a bit suspicious, but if it is correct, those people can't vote. How would they vote?
Oh, Jim, I'm glad you asked. So federal law, statutory law, says only U.S. citizens can decide U.S. elections, okay? But here's what's happening. In progressive cities, municipalities around the country, they are registering illegals to vote in local elections. They want to do it on the federal level. I think most people understand that was the design. The reason they opened the border and subjected us to all of this catastrophe is because the people in charge want to turn these folks into voters and affect the outcome of the census in 6 years. We have to prevent that from happening. Yes, it's against the law, but here's the reality. When Joe Biden and they process illegals, the ones they do encounter at the border, and they send them throughout the country, they say, when you get to wherever you're going, after taxpayers pay you for your bus ticket, plane ticket, train ride to get where you're going, go ahead and go into that local welfare office, benefits office, and sign up for public benefits, taxpayer benefits, for example, by the way. And by the way, when you're there, in every one of these offices around the country, you get a one-page form, and it says, check this box if you're a U.S. citizen and would like to vote. We have no idea of knowing how many people are doing that without proof of citizenship, because under federal law, believe it or not, under current law, the states are prohibited from requesting proof that that box is checked correctly. We have a law called the SAVE Act, a statute called the SAVE Act, a bill that we're filing, went through committee last week. It'll be passed through the House very shortly, sent to the Senate. I hope in a bipartisan fashion it will be enacted, because that will prevent illegals from actually being able to participate in November. Jim, let's just say the Department of Homeland Security's bogus number is correct. Let's say there's roughly 11 million illegals instead of 16 or 17.
And that would be over the course of many years, not just the last three.
No, Jim, that's their number for the last 3.5 years. That's the official DHS number. It's 10 million people encountered at the border and allowed in. And then they have almost 3 million known gotaways that they know that they saw and didn't stop. The scary thing is we have no idea how many people came through undetected, because there are large sectors of the border completely unprotected.
I agree there's an issue, and of course there has been an effort by both parties to resolve this, and there are people, as there were under Trump, getting into the country illegally. But can you name one person who is registered to vote illegally who might cast a ballot in the 2024 election? And I say this because...
Yes, we can. States are doing audits right now.
Okay,
Georgia,
well,
I can... The last couple of weeks.
I don't know of any.
that... Well, you got to Google it, because the states are doing audits right now. They realize that they have illegals who have registered to vote. The states that are doing that are purging their rolls right now. But there's no requirement yet under federal law until we pass this new statute to ensure that that happens. Jim, let's just say, let's say there are 6 million illegals in a country. If one out of every 100 decide to participate in the election in November, it would be enough to change an outcome.
Well, that's presuming they would vote for a particular candidate. They might vote for Trump. You just said he's doing well with Hispanic voters. That might not change the election at all. And plus, we're talking about kids. I don't think a kid's going to be able to register to vote illegally. Many of them are children.
That's true, but I said 1 in 100. Okay. If 1 in 100 of the illegals who came over the border register to vote, it's enough to throw an election. That's a serious
If they all go in one direction, yeah. If they go in one, yeah, if that happens, but you and I, and I think we agree to disagree that this is not going to be the reason why one person or the other wins, but it will be fascinating to follow, and we sure appreciate your time today, and congrats on the amazing job you have, and keep going. You've inspired Louisiana.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. We'll be back after this. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. And I just got a nice note from Speaker Johnson's office. So it is apparent that on this election integrity thing, he and some others, including yours truly, have a different point of view. But I do believe the speaker is sincere. Now, I'm looking at some of the numbers. Fox News reported in February last month that there were 7.2 illegals entered into the U.S. under Joe Biden, and the speaker said 11 million, and that's Fox News, which, as we know, is a conservative medium. But that said, we do have an election, and let's make sure that we all vote, be good citizens and vote, and that we vote legally. And with us is one Louis Wren, the head of the AFL-CIO in Louisiana. And let's start with the immigration issue. I heard former President Trump last week say that these illegals, these terrible people, as he calls them, are taking jobs from black people and Hispanics, that they're a big drain on the resources of our country and taking jobs that would go to American citizens. How do you respond to that, Louis Wren?
Well, good morning, Jim. I'm in highfalutin company with you and the Speaker of the U.S. House. The tragedy is the way that undocumented workers get treated. They kind of hold them hostage. They don't have the protection of the laws. And it ends up that they exploit one group of people to bring down the livelihoods of another group of people. It's always amazed me. There's an easy fix to undocumented workers in the workplace, and that would be enforce the law. Mm-hmm. I can't be mad at an individual who walked miles through the desert and swim the river so that they can have a better life for them and their families. You know, by the grace of God, I was born here and had that opportunity. But there are severe penalties for employers who work undocumented workers, and they just seem to be very reluctant to go after the employers. If the jobs weren't there, the people wouldn't come.
Chris Matthews, the now former pundit on MSNBC, host of Hardball, he said it on this show. He said that when it comes to that issue, that Democrats want the votes, and it's presumed that most of the votes would go to Democrats, although that is not a given. We just heard Speaker Johnson say that former President Trump is doing well with Hispanic voters, and I don't know that he's got a majority, but he's doing better than you might think. But that the Republicans want the cheap labor. Is there some truth to that?
Absolutely. There are programs in place, and particularly in agriculture. And as the guy said, Americans don't want to pick lettuce. No, Americans don't want to pick lettuce for what you want to pay. And they are a cheap labor source, and that has been a big deal in the agriculture. When they do the H-2Bs and they do it legally, it's a program that has worked. It's a tendency that some people misuse the program. people are supposed to come to the country for a specific location, for a specific job at a competitive wage, and not all employers follow the rules.
877-217-5757 for Louis Wren, head of the AFL-CIO of Louisiana, and we will go to the phone lines in a moment, but I mentioned in the open that it's been a, what some might think, a surprisingly good session for labor. You have held your own, and you have fought back some measures that you didn't like a lot. What happened?
Well, I would begin by giving credit to the Senate Labor Committee. They gave us a very fair opportunity to discuss and point out how a lot of these bills were problematic. We have seen, you know, one bill a session maybe going after, you know, unions. Most issues we deal with are issues that affect all of working people, whether they're union members or not. Of course, this is a trend we've seen in the House. But I'll give an example. One of the bills required that public employees had to have an election every year and had to win the election by 50% of the people who were eligible to vote. Well, there's nobody in the state legislature who won by a majority of 50% of the people who were eligible to vote. It's not the way democracy works. Those who show up to they're the ones that rule. But
For example, Jeff Landry, he won with 18% of the overall eligible voters.
But they wanted, and then the crazy part in these public unions, if you won the election, you still don't have the right to bargain. The right is granted by the government entity, and they only bargain if they choose to.
All right. And a question from a listener. And we will go to the phone line, so if you're on the line, please be patient. We'll get to you if we can, and I think we will. But the NCAA has agreed to pay players. This is still tied up in the courts, but if it's accepted, it'll be a $2.8 billion settlement. And in the New York Times yesterday, it says another bedrock principle remains intact, but maintaining it is likely to be a priority for the NCAA, that players who are paid by universities are not employed by them, and therefore do not have the right to collective bargaining. Now, why wouldn't they if they're getting a check from the university?
Well, I don't think I can go start my own football team and be allowed to compete. They need Congress to grant them an exemption to the antitrust law. It is the same thing that the NFL did, and it's kind of the opposite of what they wanted. The NFL has an exemption to the antitrust laws because of collective bargaining. These folks seem to want whatever rules are good in their advantage, but not anybody else's. We often forget that those football players are basically children. They're seldom over 22, 23 years old. College football is a lot like the farm team in baseball. This is where you get seen. This is where you get become attractive to be elevated into the higher paying jobs. That's what they do in the farm teams, and they pay the baseball
but
players.
Will you get involved? Will you say these guys and girls, do they deserve to have labor representation, union representation in their negotiations?
Absolutely. I think anytime a group of people can come together, they have a bigger voice and clout. I think it's the model that Lobby uses, so why wouldn't we let football players use it?
Rebel in Sherwood. Rebel, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi. Thank you so much, Jim, and thank you so much, sir, for the work you're doing. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to speak with Mega Mike, Church Lady Johnson, about those fascist lies and information.
Okay, all right. What's your question? Enough of the name-calling.
But my question, sir, is how is the Republican Party today trying to defund and destroy unions and labor rights, not just in Louisiana, but around the world? And I also agree with you that another thing they're trying to do, which is why they don't prosecute the business owners, is they're protecting their campaign donors from prosecution while demonizing immigrants.
All right. And when you get down to the root of this, too, how many U.S. senators, how many members of the U.S. Congress have, quote, illegals working for them in their homes, at their businesses? I would say that number, on a percentage basis, certainly is bigger than the number of illegals who might vote in the 2024 election. Louis Wren, am I preaching to the choir, or do you have a different opinion?
Of course. I mean, I don't know. If somebody's living underground, trying to not be detected, arrested, deported, I don't know that they're going up to sign up for anything. They avoid dealing with authority simply for their own protection. And you're right. This is, well, first of all, let me point this out. Not all Republicans drink the Kool-Aid.
And by the way, there's some Democrats. Remember Bill Clinton? He would have been better off with Zoe Baird as his attorney general. I remember he ended up Janet Reno, who was his third choice. And wasn't that over an illegal alien she had employed in her household? Now, how many members of Congress, both Democratic and Republican, have done that?
Well, in these days, that's not very good politics. But to the other subject you ask, it is, particularly in the South, an effort to diminish the voice of working men and women by trying everything they can to do union-busting activity. We saw five governors sign a letter saying, let's keep the union out of the South, particularly over the auto fight, one in Tennessee, one that lost in Alabama. What's amazing is when they were negotiating for the big three, one of the things were, if we raise wages, we can't compete with the non-union sector. As soon as that contract got settled, all of the non-union sector got a raise equal to what the union contract was. Why any public official would be against elevating the economics of its citizens and its workers, other than some folks just don't like regular working folks having a voice in this system.
David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Louis Wren. Good morning, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. Before I get to my question for the guests, please. Sir, I was the chief union steward for the OPEIU, for the largest container steamship company in New Orleans. I had 100% membership under right to work. I never lost a grievance of worker in election. My question for you, sir, is in other states throughout the country, Amazon, which is they're building a fulfillment center in Metairie, and they have one in Slidell, I believe, and Starbucks. Will the AFL-CIO make any effort to organize these companies and others in Louisiana?
The AFL-CIO will assist any union that wants to try and unionize the folks. The AFL-CIO on its own cannot negotiate a collective bargaining agreement. We assist the union. So there's also a fulfillment center for Amazon in Shreveport, and there's one that's hiring right now in Baton Rouge. We will do anything we can to assist any and all unions that want to help provide a better life for workers.
We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining me for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. And we're pleased to have for a few more moments Louis Wren, head of the Louisiana AFL-CIO, and as we know in recent years, the perception is that LABI rules the roost at the state capitol, and quite often they do, and they've got a legislature that's largely compliant. Their rating sheets have gone up and away. These numbers that LABI puts out, lawmakers are getting higher ratings because it's a more conservative legislature. And a listener asked a good point, Louis Wren. This is Holly in the Garden District. Do you have a scorecard? Does labor have a scorecard that you use?
Yes.
Is it a private scorecard or a public
yes.
one? Private scorecard. You don't go around saying what you have.
It's an unusual business. As one of my leaders told me one time, we ought to draw a line in the sand and we only deal with people who are with us all the time. I told him that's a good plan. My job real easy. Yeah. I'd have three people to talk to. there are issues that rank higher than other issues. You can end up, I remember one time Sam Jones, who was John Bell's seatmate, ended up with an 80% score with Lobby. How does that happen? I did jokingly tell him that Libby was using Common Core math to do their percentages, but that's why we keep it in house. It can be misleading, and some folks are there when you really need them, and on some other issues.
Quickly, before we'll try to take a couple calls, but please be brief when we get to you. But the tariffs, we whined, many did, about the Trump tariffs, and now Joe Biden, if anything, he's got Trump tariffs on steroids. He has not reversed the course. Labor, in many ways, likes that. Why?
Well, when you look at the country as a whole and you have to compete with other companies who don't have the same rules, they don't have the same environmental protections, they don't have the same worker protections, they may be using labor at terribly low rates and then using us to dump, which puts our people. Every country protects its own economy. Look what happened when we first started with the foreign car market. You know, I got tickled when we bailed out the auto industry. You want to talk about national security. If we let all of those fail, okay, and we had to depend on foreign countries to make our military
vehicles.
Well,
we are short, and another listener, and obviously this is one that was last week, workers in Alabama rejected to join the UAW. Was that a setback? The two Mercedes-Benz factories near Tuscaloosa voted against allowing United Automobile Workers to represent them.
Yes. You know, it's obviously not the outcome we would have liked. More than 50% of the people had signed cards, expressed their desire to have collective bargaining be represented by the union. My understanding is that there was a huge anti-union campaign, and there's been several charges brought before the National Labor Relations Board about inappropriate activity by the company.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace, please be brief. Phil, you're on with Lewis Wren.
Good morning, gentlemen. You know, when Reagan broke the transportation union air controllers.
Air traffic controllers.
Traffic controllers. The thing is, unions and union jobs make a middle class. Now, our middle class has been hollowed out since Reagan and attacking the unions.
All right, but union workers now, and it's one of those things, most of them still are Democratic, but the margins are getting closer. Why? Based on concerns expressed by people like Phil.
When they did decertify the air traffic controllers, it made it difficult time because of the fear of loss of employment. I think time has softened some of that, and we see people more willing to step up and have a voice, mm-hmm, and want to participate.
All right. Final caller for Lewis Wren today, and hopefully we'll have him back again soon. Mike in Villa Del Rey. Hello, Mike.
Good morning. Crawfish etouffee today. Lewis, how does it affect C-stores, small business, rehabilitation centers by cutting workman's comp and cutting unemployment down to 12 weeks, unless it's the unemployment rate is over 8%?
Right. Thank you, Mike.
Well, you know, I had an op-ed that was posted the other day, and it talked about the governor's inaugural speech. He wanted people to come back home. We have thousands of Louisiana workers who are working all across the country, mostly because they're being paid better. But if you cut their unemployment and you cut their workers' comp and they can't see a doctor, I don't see how these are going to encourage people to come back home. It's just another incentive. If I go work out of state, and I get laid off, I'm going to get a higher rate and a longer duration. If I get hurt on the job, I'm going to get better benefits. You know, they want to talk about Texas and Arkansas. Louisiana workers are not going to Texas and Arkansas. They're going to places that pay a lot better wages and have better benefits.
Thank you, Lewis Wren. Let's do it again soon.
Can I make one closing statement?
Well,
Just real
quick. Please be brief.
All right. So I want people to know you got a voice in this system. If you looked at that summer feeding program and we weren't going to do it, it was the outrage of the public that changed the tide. So use your voice. Speak up when you think something's wrong and you can make a difference.
Well said. Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice is with us in the home stretch, an entomologist and author of many nonfiction books. She knows the jungle well, and she lives in Raleigh with her husband, her sons, her dogs, her crabs, hermit crabs, an assortment of spiders and insects, and a small but valiant flock of homing pigeons. Her book is Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behaviors. Good morning, Dr. Rice. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, some of us have pets. I have a couple of cats, and they are, of course, members of the family, and quite often we give them human attributes, even if they're not human. How important is it to know what's going on, if we can, inside their brains?
Well, I think it's really important if you want to bond with your pet, because not only is it neat, because a lot of times the things that you think are going on actually have some really cool connections with their wild ancestors, but it also just helps you to connect with your pets better.
Well, you note that cats have instincts to scratch, don't we know it? So you can get tall, sturdy, scratching posts for your cats, and this might give them a place to scratch that's not on the back of your couch. I know.
No, that's true.
So that's for those of us who are like felines. That's an issue. You don't want to buy a nice couch if you know it's going to be fodder for your cat.
No, and your cat will go where your cat wants to go to scratch. That's true. But you know, one thing that's really cool about cats, like your cat, is that we have been keeping cats for over 10,000 years as pets, and so our cats and ourselves, we've co-evolved together to understand each other in ways that wild animals will never understand us, and we'll never understand wild animals.
Now, when I was a little kid, I used to have birds, parakeets, and you say if the birds aren't looking in the bird cage for the loves of their lives or hurling food, they're setting up invisible force fields. It's time to read between the tweets to find out what really is going on.
That's true. It's true. Birds are incredible because they have such intricate communication. So you had parakeets, you said?
I did.
Okay, so the parakeets, they have to learn each other's songs just right. Because if the male does not sing a song the way the female wants him to sing a song, she may mate with him, but she will actually go find a secret lover and get him to father her children, and then she'll make the guy who's not as good of a singer come and take care of her babies for her.
All right. Now, dogs continue to be loved by many, and they are loyal, but they take more attention than cats and birds. But you say a dog's tail is a window into their sunny little souls. Why?
Well, if you watch the way a dog wags its tail, there's been a lot of research on tail wags. You can tell how that dog is feeling. So you know that if the tail's up, then you have its attention. If the tail's tucked under, it's trying to play or it's afraid. But it goes even deeper than that, because researchers found that if the dog wags its tail to the left, that means that they're nervous and they're unsure. And if the dog wags its tail to the right, that means that they're happy and they want to make friends. And even more interesting than that is if another dog watches a dog wag its tail to the left, the other dog's heart rate will start going crazy and it'll start panting and behaving nervously because it senses something's off, because the dog wagging its tail to the left is letting it know with that left wag.
Well, we're short on time, but you say it's no secret that dogs are super great at making their way home. Cats have done that too, but you have one where a dog walked, 2,500 miles?
Yeah, isn't that wild? Bobby the Wonder Dog. And she did it using Earth's electromagnetic field, which we can all see with our dogs every time they go outside and go to the bathroom. Because when dogs go to the bathroom, 9 times out of 10, when they stop, you know, you can picture a dog spinning in circles. When they stop, they align their bodies with the north-south axis of Earth's electromagnetic field.
Well, thank you, Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice. Her book, Your Pet's Secret Lives. It's a good one. Until tomorrow, same time, same place. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.